So the second guest of today is Sasha Migdal. Sasha was a pioneer in the study of homomorphic Turing, H Turing. He's back to theoretical physics after a short hiatus funding companies. Well, tell us about turbulence, new approaches for it, and how to solve it.
Okay. So my talk is called Quantum Solution of Classical Turbulence. And what that means is that the classical probability distribution of the turbulent flow is exactly related to certain quantum mechanical systems in lower dimension. And that miracle happened recently. And because of that miracle, which I call duality, we could find exact formulas for the decaying turbulence, for the spectrum of decaying turbulence. The problem which was considered to be impossible to solve, so much so that theoretical physics kind of dropped the ball and decided that turbulence is not a problem in theoretical physics, because there were times when Feynman and Zagier, Heisenberg, Landau all tried to solve it. Then they didn't solve. Then Kolmogorov found something which looked like solution but led to the ice wall, and it was impossible to climb that ice wall. That happened 80 years ago. And since that time, turbulence was thought to be not solvable because it was attacked, as I claim, with wrong methods, with classical methods. Turned out there is exact duality between three-dimensional turbulent problem and one-dimensional quantum system, which I am going to describe now. And that produced exact results for the observable thing, which is a spectrum of decaying turbulence. So the turbulence problem looks deceptively simple. Find the limit of the solution of Navier-Stokes equations when viscosity goes to zero at fixed energy dissipation rate. So this is Navier-Stokes equation, and that's incompressibility condition, which is used to eliminate the pressure. And in this limit, when viscosity, which enters this term, goes to zero, Navier-Stokes tends to so-called Euler equation, which is just time derivative equals V cross V minus gradient. And that is happening everywhere except some singular regions where gradients are so large that this term can no longer be neglected. And that phenomenon is well known in turbulence. It's called boundary layer, or in context of the Euler equations, it's called vortex sheets. There are some singular solutions which are in fact resolved by this term. When you keep finite but arbitrarily small viscosity, you'll have very thin singular sheets or singular lines. And that's exactly what happens in that limit. That's a problem we're going to describe. So Navier-Stokes equation tends to Euler equation everywhere except some singular regions, vortex sheets and lines, where large velocity gradients could compensate the factor of nu. These regions are randomly distributed in space, making velocity and vorticity stochastic variables at every point, which with local vorticity values divergent in the turbulent limit. So there is a random distribution of singular vortex structures. And at every given point, with certain probability, one of these structures will be nearby, or you find time evolution, it will cross any singular point. So it's called intermittency. At every point in space, vorticity with some probability could become singular. So it's a stochastic variable. That is the essence of turbulence. There is stochastic distribution of singular structures, which makes vorticity and velocity stochastic variables. Now, in original theory, which is Navier-Stokes equations, the limit of so-called entropy. Entropy is average square of vorticity. Omega is vorticity. So average square of vorticity diverges. If you take product of vorticity at point zero and point r and tend r to zero, it will diverge as some negative power of r. And there is exact relation that energy dissipation is viscosity times this thing, entropy. It's omega omega called entropy. So viscosity times this viscosity goes to zero, this distance point splitting goes to zero, and the result is finite. And that's energy dissipation. So essence of this turbulence is this anomaly, that there is singular behavior of entropy which compensates small small viscosity, and therefore there is finite energy dissipation. So we want to tend viscosity to zero, but still we want to change, tend other parameters of the theory to such a limit that the energy dissipation stays finite. In the theory I'm going to describe here, there is a similar formula for the same quantity, energy dissipation. It's proportional to viscosity times n squared, where n is the number of these fermions on our auxiliary surface. In my dual quantum system, n is number of particles, number of degrees of freedom. So we, in statistical limit, when number of degrees of freedom goes to infinity, we could tend viscosity to zero, and in the end we get the same dissipation anomaly. We have anomalous dissipation, which is finite in spite of zero viscosity. That's the essence of the turbulence, anomalous dissipation. We have it in our theory also. So the theoretical approach to turbulence, in my view, started in 1952, not in 1941, when Kolmogorov suggested his phenomenological theory, which turned out to be only approximately correct. Kolmogorov theory is not a theory, it's a model which is only approximately correct. And the correct approach was outlined in 52 by Hopf. And his approach was a very general thing. It's called generation. It's the Z generating functional, which generates probability distribution of velocity fields. So J is a source, and every expectation value is the average over some initial data. So you presume that the flow is unstable. So if you have some distribution of initial data or boundary values, it doesn't really matter what you have are averaging, because equation doesn't depend on the nature of averaging. So if you average over, say, initial data, this exponential, you'll get the generating function for probability distribution of velocity. And that was introduced by Hopf, who noticed that this object satisfies a certain functional differential equation. So it's time derivative. If you differentiate with respect to time, it only involves velocity here. So time derivative of velocity goes down from exponential, and you get some expression which Hopf managed to write as some operator depending on the source and functional derivatives with respect to source. So this is linear equation. Original equation was nonlinear, and this one is linear. That's a transformation which was suggested by Hopf. And he said, OK, solve this equation, and you will find the probability distribution. In absence of viscosity, we know the solution of this equation. It's called Gibbs distribution. The fixed point of this equation is simply the Gibbs distribution, because in absence of viscosity, there is thermal equilibrium. There, one of the solutions for distribution would be thermal equilibrium. And of course, it satisfies this equation. But we don't want to tend viscosity to zero yet. We want to tend it to zero, but don't want to set it equal to zero. But arbitrary small viscosity is dissipation, and therefore, Gibbs distribution is no longer a solution of the Hopf equation. So what we are looking for is some degenerate fixed point of Navier-Stokes dynamics, in the same way as Gibbs distribution is a degenerate fixed point of Newton dynamics. Gibbs distribution describes the energy surface. So there is uniform distribution across the energy surface. And of course, it's very degenerate. It's just a surface, hypersurface in multidimensional space. It has a lot of parameters, because the surface is described by sum of squares of velocity plus potential. And at any values of velocity and coordinates, you could move from one point to another. So it's a very degenerate fixed point. It's not one singular point in functional space. It's a surface. And we're looking for a similar thing, which could be replacement of the Gibbs distribution. So I want to tell you something very important. All of us in this audience, and that me included, were used to critical phenomena in quantum field theory and statistical mechanics. All these critical phenomena starts with the magic words, Hamiltonian has the form. You have to average over all degrees of freedom of exponential of minus something called inverse temperature times some well-defined local action. And that's the problem we used to solve. Here, in turbulence, there is no such definition. We have to derive that definition. In other words, there is no Gibbs distribution, and the whole problem is you start from Navier-Stokes, you have to find the substitute of the Gibbs distribution, and then you solve it. So, if there are questions at this point, I would answer. Okay, well, yes?
Could you remind us what is the definition of the partition function with all the source?
What?
Without the source, what is the partition function?
Partition function?
Yeah, here, the functional. Equation 5.
It's a functional of J. J is a function of three coordinates, so this Z is a functional of this J.
Yes, but without the source, what's the measure?
Oh, the measure, yes. It's a very good question. We'll answer that question later. Here, the measure does not matter. You could average, you see, that's the idea. You take arbitrary random initial data. Doesn't matter with what measure. But then it evolves, and then it covers some fixed point, for some surface, with uniform measure or some dynamical measure. So you don't have to specify the measure because you have initial data, random initial data for the Navier-Stokes equation, and then solution evolves. And then it's a dynamical question what would be a measure. So the measure of the initial data doesn't matter because we expect that regardless of initial data, we approach the same fixed point. And the measure will be the measure of that fixed point.
And you want 6. In relation to that question, yes, no, the question, what depends on time here? Is it the measure itself that something?
Well, velocity depends on time. What else?
Come again?
Velocity depends on time.
Okay, fair enough. Velocity.
And satisfies Navier-Stokes equation. It's time derivative x over the right side of the Navier-Stokes equation.
Yes, and we were averaging over some initial conditions then? Over.
Yes, averaging over initial conditions, yes.
Yeah.
So, the decaying turbulence is a degenerate fixed trajectory, slowly approaching the stable fixed point. In other words, we don't expect, if we don't introduce energy source and there is viscosity, which means dissipation, then we know what is the fixed point. It's just velocity equals zero. Eventually, after eon passed, after a long time, the velocity will stop. But the fixed trajectory is universal approach to the fixed point. So we expect that at large times, there will be some universal regime, which is some universal functional of dynamical variables, times, say, negative power of time, or something like that. And that is what we are looking for. So it's called fixed trajectory. So a trajectory which depends on time, but is universal otherwise. The Hopf equation for Navier-Stokes dynamics is compatible with such a trajectory. But it's too complex to compute anything. Its complexity is equivalent to the non-Gaussian functional integral. Misplacing turbulence in the same category as critical phenomena in statistical physics. So when you naively look at the Hopf equation, you say, it's very similar to Schwinger-Dyson functional equations in quantum field theory. There's a source depending on three-dimensional coordinates. So it looks like three-dimensional, some non-trivial three-dimensional field theory, and it's critical phenomena in that field theory. But it's even more complex than critical phenomena because we don't have Hamiltonian. So what is it? So the good news is that it's much simpler. It was misplaced in the critical phenomena category. It's something which can be solved explicitly and is much simpler than field theory. So here is the long path which led to that solution. So there was this Hopf equation, and then there was you know, sometime in the 80s, there was QCD loop equation. So it was found that in gauge theory, you could find the equation for the so-called Wilson loop, exponential circulation, and you could find functional equation for this QCD, and that is non-perturbative equation. It was solved in a couple of non-perturbative cases, such as Iguchi-Kawai model or some other cases. So it is known to work, but it was not exactly solved because it's nonlinear. In case of the Navier-Stokes equation, loop equation, which I am going to present here, it was derived in 93, 94. This loop equation in Navier-Stokes is linear, but non-local. So it is a linear equation, which was analyzed for quite some time. Since the 95 to 2019, we could only produce some WKB limits, some simple solutions. There's area law, that Wilson loop in the Navier-Stokes equation decays as exponential of area inside the loop. But it looks so complex that it was impossible to solve. Then there was some progress when it was observed that if you go to momentum loop, then into Fourier, which is dual variable with respect to loop, it's a momentum loop, Fourier transform, functional Fourier transform. When you go to that, equation simplifies. And then there was a breakthrough 2 years ago when I found that there is a simple exact solution of this equation, which I called Euler ensemble. It is some very well-defined system in number theory. And then a year later, I reformulated it in terms of fermions on a ring. And then a few months ago, I found the solution, which is described by Instanton, and this led to exact solution, which I'm going to present here. So now let me go to the actual equations. I'm not going to derive anything. I'm not going to explain all the details because it will take maybe 5 hours, and I have only one. So we will have another seminar, which also will be probably 1 hour, where I will answer questions, and you could read the paper and ask questions. And if you are interested in mathematical details, I would be happy to answer. So a loop equation corresponds to a particular case of that source. So the Hopf functional involves the source. And let's take the source, which is concentrated on a loop. So this is three-dimensional delta function, and it's integral over loop of three-dimensional delta function. That means that for every point r which does not belong to the loop, it is zero, and exactly at the loop it is infinite, but so it is defined like that. And loop average will be, if you take Hopf functional and substitute this singular loop current into Hopf functional, you will get just exponential of some factor times circulation. Circulation is integral of velocity of around the loop. That's a very well-known object in loop in fluid dynamics. There are theorems about conservation in Euler equation. So it's a nice object. Nice property of that object is that the potential part of velocity, which is gradient of some scalar, will drop in the circulation. So if you take add v to v some gradient of some scalar function, this integral over closed loop for arbitrary shape loop will be zero, just because it will be total derivative of some periodic function. And therefore, and that's big simplification, because potential part of velocity is something which is not universal in turbulence. Potential part of velocity is has a long range correlation proportional to positive power of r, which means it doesn't decrease with distance. However, the circulation, which is related to vorticity, is a well-defined object because correlations of vorticity decrease as some negative power of coordinate. And by the way, to those of you who love conformal field theories, which was also my love in my youth, turbulence is not a conformal field theory. It's extremely trivial to see that it is not a conformal field theory, because in conformal field theory, the conserved current, which is current with divergence equals zero, has normal dimension. But in case of turbulence, we have two conserved currents, velocity and vorticity. And one is gradient of another, so they cannot have the same dimension, end of story. That's why there is no conformal symmetry in the turbulence. Moreover, the dimension of each of them is very far from what conformal symmetry would predict for conserved current. So forget about conformal invariance, and the origin of the violation of conformal invariance is, of course, non-locality. Conformal invariance usually follows from Gibbs distribution or action with some local Hamiltonian, and there is scale invariance, and then you go to higher scales, and then there is an anomalous, there is dilatation operator, anomalous dimension, et cetera, et cetera. It's based on locality. Now, in our case, because of incompressibility of velocity, there is no locality. And therefore, there is a rather picture of large vortices interacting with each other at long distances, and it's not a local theory. Okay, so still it satisfies some closed loop equation. And this loop equation, you take time derivative of psi, and you get integral of two terms. One is curl of vorticity, another is velocity cross vorticity. And then I skip a lot of mathematical parts. And then this equation can be written as integral over loop. And these terms in the brackets can be written as some operator containing a functional derivative with respect to the loop. So in the same way as Hopf managed to represent time derivative of his functional by means of functional derivative with respect to the source, I do the same here. However, the most important and interesting part of this equation is that this operator L does not depend explicitly on the loop. It only depends on functional derivative. So in coordinate space, it's a horrible operator, and it's impossible to solve. However, the more horrible it is in coordinate space, the better it is in momentum space. If you have a Hamiltonian which depends on momentum and doesn't depend on coordinate, everybody knows that you have to go to momentum space, do Fourier transformation, and you will get plane waves or superposition of plane waves. And that's how you solve the Schrödinger equation for the system which does not depend on coordinates. So that's exactly the case here. It took me 30 years to understand how to actually do it. But it was clear from the very beginning, once this equation was derived in 1993, that you should go to momentum space. So once you go to momentum space, you use what is called a plane wave. In this particular case, your loop space has, instead of coordinate x, you have a whole loop. And analog of the plane wave will be this integral over the loop of some unknown function p, which depends on theta. Theta is internal coordinate. So in loop space, objects are points in loop space are loops. And in conjugate momentum space, they are also loops, but in another space. And that's transformation. Yes?
What is your angular bracket?
Angular bracket, very good question. I will answer that question right away. So in initial theory, angular bracket was averaging over initial data. Here, the angular bracket is averaging on yet to be determined manifold of parameters for the solution for p. So it will be a fixed point. So we, first of all, we have to derive equation for p. It's if the original Hamiltonian had this form, then it's trivial to see that for this ansatz, for this p, equation will be time derivative of p will be the same operator L, where instead of functional derivative with respect to c, we have just theta derivative of p. That's how they are related. P is conjugate to c prime. And conversely, C is conjugate to P prime.
So
I wish I would know now how to make it forever, but I don't know. Yeah.
Sasha, it's great to see you.
Yes.
The question is, do you know that you stole, we stole all this from you when we made the quantum gravity?
Say it again.
We stole all these techniques from you when we made the quantum gravity.
Yes.
So I don't know if you know that.
Well, when I was, for the last 40 years, first loop equation was derived in 83.
Right.
Since that time, there were a lot of developments, both in physics and in mathematics. And there was loop space, which was introduced, and in gravity later than 83.
Gravity was also about 83.
Huh?
I'll show it to you later. We also developed in 83.
83?
Yes.
Well, loop equation in QCD was derived in some time. No, it was derived in 79. I'm sorry. Loop equation by Makeyenko and myself was derived in 79, and the review paper of mine was published in 83. It's called Loop Equations and 1/n Expansion.
Well, I'm making a compliment. I'm saying we know this work very well because we took it from you.
And I make quotation to application of loop techniques to gravity because I think it was an important development.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. So, of course, in my paper, I describe all the story, and that part of the story was that this was used for the loop gravity, which is in a very important contribution. But for this particular case, the technique which I used was not the same. It was different. The main thing was Fourier transformation. So the equation which you get for momentum loop is very well defined, but nonlinear. It involves discontinuity of momentum loop, and it involves principal value of momentum loop. There are no approximation here. You just take exactly the same equation you have in coordinate space, and in momentum space it becomes very simple equation in the sense that the right side doesn't depend on time, doesn't depend on theta. It's universal but singular functional. And remarkably, it can be solved. So, momentum loop in QCD, there were similar momentum loop equations in QCD, but in QCD, the solutions could have a smooth part plus arbitrary number of discontinuities on top of smooth part. But in Navier-Stokes theories, the discontinuities must be present at every point. In other words, it has to be the fractal. And why is it so? If you look at this equation, you will see that the right side vanishes if delta p equals 0. So it will be a contradiction. If at any point delta p is non-zero, then at that point p will be constant. And then at another point where it is non-zero, it will not be constant. So it is easy to see that as it is, equation describes the fractal. And the way to approximate it is to take a limit of the polygon. So first of all, we have to find what is vorticity. Vorticity in this technique is described by basically cross product of delta p and p. And that, by the way, explains. So vorticity, as we expect, is present everywhere. I mean, it shouldn't be the places where there is no vorticity. It is a random variable, which should be present everywhere. So vorticity is cross product of delta p and p, and velocity is obtained by solution of the Poisson equation, which in these notations means simply dividing by delta p squared, because derivative is just delta p. That's one of the points of the correspondence, that the gradient corresponds to delta p, so velocity equals this. And there's also Bianchi identity, which is an important part, because not every functional of the loop, which you could imagine, for example, the length of the loop, can be represented as an integral of the Stokes kind of integral of vorticity inside the loop. So that condition leads to Bianchi identity. So every solution of loop equation must satisfy Bianchi identity, otherwise it's not describing vector field theory. But here, fortunately, it does satisfy, because our vorticity is cross product of velocity of p and delta p. So if you multiply by one more delta p and sum over cyclic permutation, you get identically zero. So that means that this is a right class of solutions. Now, here is the first surprise. The first surprise is that because there is no time dependence in the right side of the loop equation, and it's nonlinear equation, the left side involves time derivative of p, and the right side is a third degree homogeneous polynomial. Therefore, ta-da, the time dependence factorizes. It's 1 over square root of t plus some constant times some function which could be constant. If you consider that as a transformation and write down equation for the function f, then you will find out that this equation has translation invariance in terms of log t, and therefore it has solution with f equals constant. So, and here is another miracle, that in fact this solution can be explicitly written down. So let me describe it. I'm not going to explain how I arrived at that solution. It took me a long way with numerical simulations, tries and guesses, etc., etc. But in the end, I found an analytic solution, not numerical. So these alpha k are angles which are related to each other by recurrent equations. So the next one is related to previous one, plus some parameter beta times a variable which is plus minus one, like an Ising model. Equations, so I'm just explaining how if I substitute this ansatz into the loop equations, they will be satisfied provided alpha k plus one equals alpha k plus minus beta. And the periodicity condition, because that has to be closed loop, means that beta times sum over all sigma equals integer fractional integer multiple of 2 pi. So this is a very degenerate fixed trajectory. So there is n variables, and of course n has to go to infinity, because this formula satisfies the discrete version when there are n points on a polygon, and I'm approximating differences by discontinuities by differences and principal values by arithmetic sum of the values at neighboring points. So I have to tend n to infinity. But first I have to solve the theory and then tend n to infinity in the solution, because the system becomes very non-trivial at large n. And as we shall see, this is the whole point, how to find statistical limit n going to infinity in this theory.
Can I just while we're staring at the equation, is there a planar symmetry or something where the third direction is special? Or
well, this is a three-dimensional case.
Sure. So, but like the third component is just fixed.
Third component is constant. Thank you for that question. Yes, third component is constant, and that's the whole point. Third component doesn't depend on k. And therefore, if you find the loop integral, if you take this f times, if you find sum delta c k times f k. You'll find out the constant term in Fk will drop. So it will be the same as sum of delta Ck times last term equals zero because it is, doesn't depend on K. Because some, oh, the only thing we know about the loop C is that it's closed. Sum of delta Ck equals zero. Or you could sum this by parts and say it is minus sum Ck delta Fk, and then you see that any constant term drops from this. So this last component is the only one which is imaginary. The rest is real. So in general, this F is a complex vector. It has to be complex because it satisfies the complex equation, right? Our equation, if you look at that, is complex. There's I gamma. Why is it complex? Because I introduced in the exponential I gamma. And why did I do that? I did that because of a very important thing. The distribution of circulation in experiment is only a power. It is only exponential. It's exponential, therefore, if I introduce a real gamma here, if I would have, like Hoppe, used a real source instead of imaginary, it would not exist. It will converge in one direction, not converge in another. So I have to use this Fourier. And then the meaning of that is very simple. The complex conjugation of this wave function corresponds to time reversal. My theory is not time symmetric. And time reversal corresponds to change of the sign of the velocity circulation because velocity circulation is integral of velocity times dr, and velocity is odd with respect to time reflection. So this functional psi has to be complex, unlike Wilson loop, which is real. This thing has to be complex because there is no symmetry with respect to reflection of the sine of the circulation. So reflection of the sine of the circulation would correspond to complex conjugation of this psi. So psi is complex, but circulation still has to be real. You know, circulation is represented in this case by integral of this f over loop. So for circulation to be real, this sum has to be real. And that's what happens because the last term, which is imaginary term in F, drops. So this is a unique solution. It satisfies complex equation, but it is because of this special gauge invariance, so to say, it is equivalent to real circulation. So it is a complex solution with real circulation. And that's a very non-trivial thing because when I was trying to solve some of these things numerically, that was something which was very difficult to achieve because the generic solution of the loop equation would be complex. And only this one has this remarkable property that it has real circulation.
Yes, if your loops have kinks in them, are they still solutions?
What?
If you had to take your loop,
yes,
and if you bring it that closed,
oh,
the kink.
Well, for me, the loop is any periodic function. It has 21 closed loops. It could be one intersected 75 times. It doesn't matter. Any periodic function is called a loop.
So you're sure it doesn't matter if there's a kink?
Absolutely no matter. First of all, we're talking about fluid dynamics where there is no singularities. There is no ultraviolet singularities at finite viscosity. So it's not gauge theory. There will be singularities in the limit of viscosity going to zero, but at finite viscosity, everything is fine. You, by the way, could substitute my ansatz into loop equation and with finite polygon instead of the smooth loop, and you will see that it, term by term, becomes Navier-Stokes equation because velocity at fixed viscosity is smooth. So it's not, there is no divergence. It's not a tricky thing like in QCD. It's only tricky in the limit of viscosity going to zero. So this is the solution, not the only one, but it is the solution of loop equation. You could substitute, you could tend n to infinity term by term and see how it becomes solution. Of course, I didn't prove that's the only solution. It could be that there is a more general one. So, you know, we cannot prove anything in physics. You didn't even prove the ergodic hypothesis. So instead of waiting 100 more years until mathematicians would prove ergodic hypothesis, people just assumed it and then studied the consequences. That's what I'm trying to do here. I have very specific project for solution. I'm studying it and see how it works. Yes?
One question to understand the unicity of the solution to see if that you can generate more solution would be to identify a group of symmetries that preserve. And here you have something very specific because...
Oh, there is a rotational and translational symmetry. You should be able to translate the loop in space and you should be able to rotate it an arbitrary rotational matter. So it's full translational symmetry in three dimensions plus rotational symmetry. That's it. No, nothing else.
You also have that the time dependence was getting in the P.
Who said that? It decays with time and goes to zero.
Equation 20.
Oh, T naught is arbitrary parameter, yes. There was no time was not explicit in equation. Of course, origin of time is arbitrary. What do you expect? There is no time dependent explicit time dependence in Navier-Stokes. So of course, the general solution will have arbitrary time shift as a parameter. So yes, and I wanted to tell you there is also parameter omega. Omega is rotational matrix. So my solution, what I wrote here, is the most general solution, which is rotationally invariant and translationally invariant. Translation invariant is rather obvious because, you know, it only contains delta C. So translating of the whole loop would not change anything, right? So if you translate loop by a constant, it obviously will not change. Now, a rotational invariant is there because I forcedly integrated over rotation matrix, because I took a particular solution and integrated over all rotation matrices which belong to a rotation group. So I started at 6 minutes later. It was not my fault, so I will end 6 minutes later also. So I want to stress that it's not a toy model which looks like Navier-Stokes, and therefore we hope it will be in the same universality class. It's not what people usually do. People usually write exact equations and say, okay, now here is something which should be similar, and that let's assume it. I claim it's exact stochastic solution of Navier-Stokes. I don't claim it as a model. I claim it is exact stochastic solution of three-dimensional Navier-Stokes equation. Now, here is partition function of the system. You could find exactly partition function. You should sum over all n. This phi of q is number of rational numbers, p and q. And this is a combinatorial factor which selects a number of Ising variables such that their sum is equal to whatever we need for the closure of the loop. So that's a calculable thing. It uses some well-known, beautiful theorems of number theory, and result is this. So you could find exact singular solution for the partition function. But you could do much more. You could represent the whole Euler ensemble, this object, which involves n spins and random fraction. You could represent it in terms of fermions, after which you could solve it exactly. And I will skip some steps. What I'm doing is I'm representing sum over all possible spins by means of what is called Markov process. So there are n spins on the ring, okay? You could simultaneously sum over all possible values of them, or you could randomly pick one after another, and each time you have conditional probability for remaining. That's called Markov chain. When you do that, you'll get your partition function as product of some called Markov matrices. And these matrices have transitions from n, so sum of sigmas equals n, and it go to n minus 1, or it could stay n minus 1 with some probability, or it could stay the same with another probability. And there are very simple factors, which are just number of remaining spins because they are all equivalent. So this Markov process, and that's now something which for a physicist is almost obvious, but mathematicians would be surprised, because that can be represented by means of fermionic creation and inhalation operators. You see, a spin variable takes plus minus one value, and occupation numbers of fermionics, takes value 0 and 1. It's a very easy map. So we introduce these fermionic operators. And now I skip some details which are intuitively clear, but I don't want to dwell on that. I could represent this matrix Q in terms of occupation numbers of these fermions, and then here, sigma equals 2 nu minus 1. Nu is the occupation number at a given point on the ring. So, and here's the result. You could write the same. Now, it is exact formula for Wilson loop or loop average in decaying turbulence. So it has quantum trace of certain operators times exponential of circulation, and circulation is represented in the same way as before, except everywhere this formula has operators. So this alpha angle, which I introduced in my solution, becomes an operator related to the occupation numbers of the fermions. So it's all the almost trivial transformation. But with this transformation, you could go to AKB. The thing is that you need to tend viscosity to zero, right? And that would lead to the WKB limit of the whole partition function. And in that WKB limit, this partition function will be determined by an instanton, which I am going to compute now. So I'll skip this part, which is, this trivial part of this matrices, which has to reproduce the combinatorial factors, and I check that they indeed reproduce these factors. I assume that the occupation numbers become a smooth curve. So in the quasi-classical limit, instead of the plus one or zero, you have accumulated density, which is sum from zero to n, and that accumulated density becomes the smooth function of index on a ring. So then I check that indeed, if I write classical equations for that action, and then I will compute, I will get exactly Stirling formula for the combinatorial factor, which I obtained by conventional methods. But then, of course, it's much more interesting because now we could compute correlation functions. Now we could compute the same functional integral in a situation where instanton will be non-trivial, when the exponential factor would also take part in the computation. So here is exact formula for correlation function of two vorticities. So I will skip the derivation. It is something which, for somebody who knows the gauge theories and loop equations, is quite trivial. You take the loop, which you shrink to the backtracking, and there is insertion of two vorticities at the beginning and end. It's like area derivative at one point, area derivative at another point, and the wires backtracking between these two points. So if you write this down, you will have something like that. So you will have circulation becomes equal to the vector r between these two points divided by square root of time, and then there is some results which obtained from the computation of circulations, and you will have this exact formula for fixed n. Now you want to send n to infinity, and that becomes integral, and that integral is dominated by the instanton, and this time instanton is non-trivial because this term in the action would also play the role in the classical equation. This term is also large, and it will play its role, and that is what makes the whole solution much less trivial. And it becomes simpler if you go to momentum space. If you go to momentum space, you integrate over r with the weight e minus ikr, and then this thing becomes delta function. And this delta function, after integration over rotation matrices, will become one-dimensional delta function. So we'll skip some details. And in the end, we have explicit analytic expression. And this explicit analytic expression can be compared with experiments. Now, what happens with... That's basically the last few minutes of my talk. The experiments are done for the decaying turbulence. People pump a lot of energy in the flow, either physically by pumping it from the corners of big glass cube of water and watching what's happening in the middle, or in the chain, or in the channel. So there are many, many ways of doing that. There are clean ways and dirty ways. The numerical simulation also can be done. You could add random forces to the Navier-Stokes, pump enough energy by means of this random force, then turn off random forces and see how the energy decays. You could observe the energy spectrum. You could observe the dependence of energy of time. And energy has a non-trivial dependence of time. And now let me show you what happens from this with this theory. So in our theory, what we have is some universal function depending on the momentum, the spectrum, E of kt is a spectrum. It's some universal function depending on momentum times square root of nu t. Nu tilde is a effective, what I call turbulent viscosity. It's a limit of viscosity times n squared. It's a finite quantity. So you have this spectrum, and this h is a very non-trivial function, which I'm not going to discuss now. But it's explicitly expressed in the objects of the number theory, like gamma function, zeta function, and all these objects, some horrible integral representation involving objects of the number theory and Riemann hypothesis. Anyway, it's explicit answer. And then you could plot this h at large. At large, you plot its tail at large momentum is calculable rather easily. And it decays as a momentum to the 7/2. Now, experimentally, nobody really measured that because nobody really reached large momentum. Nobody really reached large Reynolds number. Basically, nobody predicted anything, so there was no incentive for experimentalists to measure anything. So they measured something dirty. And here's what they measured. They measured the total energy as a function of time. And there are many, each curve is independent experiment. They are compiled by Srinivasan and his co-authors for me. So most of these curves are for too short time or for too small Reynolds number. Only the green curve is smooth and lasts for long enough time. And here is my theoretical curve, which is computed using these number theory functions, and it's very similar. Asymptotically, it goes to 7/4, which is 1.75, and this one raises to about the same value, like 1.7, I guess, but it's a smaller time. So here I go, it's somewhere here. It's somewhere around 150. So I continued my curve further to 10,000, and it will reach this limit 7/4. So I have very explicit predictions. They're totally unexpected because they don't look like single clean powers. They look like some universal functions of number theory, which are calculable with some effort. And I haven't yet computed them exactly, only asymptotically or numerically. So I hope with help of some smart grad students and postdocs, I will be able to reliably compute the whole curve of the spectrum because it is universal function. You could compute it with 100,000 digits if you have a quantum computer. So I just want to do that. But the point is, solution is there. It is solution in quadrature. It's all expressed in terms of integrals of elementary and non-elementary functions like zeta function. Now, let me summarize it. So what could go wrong, or what is a weak point of this theory? Well, the main kind of cornerstone of this theory is the reduced version of the Hopf equation. Hopf equation is a very well-known studied equation. You know that it describes what we know of turbulence. If you expand the Hopf equation in terms of nonlinearity, which means expansion in inverse powers of viscosity, so it's called perturbative expansion. If you expand that, you'll get term by term the same thing as iterations of the Navier-Stokes equation in inverse powers of viscosity. So you get something. Now, what I claim, which can be proven, which I did in my review papers, is that you do the same thing with the loop equation. You take the loop equation and you iterate solution of the loop equation starting from its value at shrunk loop, which is 1, by definition psi of loop, which is shrunk to 0 equals 1. You iterate it starting from this 1. Term by term, you get, assuming that the Stokes type functional, term by term, you get the same thing as you get in ordinary perturbation theory. So my solution sums perturbation theory. But it's solution beyond perturbation theory. It's a solution in the opposite limit. Instead of, so perturbation theory corresponds to small coupling, and what I'm doing is WKB. WKB is a large coupling. So I'm considering extremely large coupling limit of the Navier-Stokes equation, and I claim it is equal to the weak coupling limit of certain dual theory. And those of you, I thought maybe half of the audience here or more is familiar with ADS-CFT duality. It is something like an icon which is somewhere in the corner. You pray and then go back to your work. So duality is a very well-known phenomenon in quantum theory. There is one theory for which there is a strong coupling, and that equals to weak coupling of another theory. Both theories are equal each other non-perturbatively, but if you, they satisfy hypothetically the same dynamical equation, but one of them is the weak coupling limit, another is a strong coupling limit, and maybe there is a phase transition so that it's not a smooth transition from weak to strong coupling. So that's what I claim is happening here. So I did not prove that I found the only and the correct solution, because Navier-Stokes equation is linear. Equation for the fixed trajectory or fixed point is also nonlinear equation. And therefore, there could be many solutions. Any solution with finite number of parameters would not work. So that would not correspond to turbulence. Turbulence, by definition, is the singular solution with infinite number of parameters. So check here. It is infinite dimensional. Second check is that it has the most important phenomena in turbulence, which is anomalous dissipation. So viscosity goes to 0, but you don't get Euler equation. You get something else, which has anomalous dissipation. Viscosity goes to 0, entropy goes to infinity. The product, which is dissipation, stays finite. So these two properties are there. And there are other, you know, kind of good signs. For example, this curve, which I obtained, could have been totally off the marks. It could go exponentially. It could go to a totally wrong number. No, it is within experimental range. So I have measurable predictions, which could be now compared with experiment. But of course, much more important than that, what I expect from experts, which I hope are present here, which I know are present here, I expect experts criticize it. I don't want you to believe me. I want you to doubt. And then I want you to try to look for bugs, try to correct my computations. Maybe I made some mistakes or errors or something. So that's normal thing. What I claim is there is a path to the solution. And I went that path, but the path is so steep and so slippery, so I may have made a couple of wrong steps, and I invite everybody to help me finish that.
So why again you took the green curve and not say the yellow one to compare with the experiment?
I looked at all these curves in the paper which I analyzed with Srini. There are two kinds of initial data. Well, not initial data, boundary bound data. There are systems with pumping energy starting as square of momentum. And there are systems with pumping energy starts as k to the fourth. The difference is that if there is a finite total momentum, linear momentum, not rotational, but linear momentum, then the energy will start times momentum squared times k squared. But if you set this momentum to zero, which is my case, I checked that in my theory it is zero, then it should start with a k to the fourth. So I think this yellow curve is the one which corresponds to the k squared. And those are ending at smaller values of asymptotic index. So which one of these is correct? I don't know. These are some theoretical, quote unquote, values obtained from perturbative equations. They truncated, prayed that some, closure is correct or some phenomenology. So there is no theory. But these phenomenological predictions don't work. So there are two smooth curves here, really. One is the green one, another is the blue one. So I don't know. I cannot claim that I fit experiment. I claim only that experiment is all over the place and I'm in the same range.
All right, I'm not sure if I have a good question. So in your set of solutions, like the time dependence was the same for the full class of solutions, right? It was like 1 over square root t.
Well, I only predict the behavior for the k to the fourth class.
Oh.
In principle, I could modify my equations and see what happens if I add concentration. That means the following. There is a generic solution for the velocity in terms of vorticity. Yeah. In general, velocity equals some constant plus Biot-Savart integral. So to the Biot-Savart integral, which expresses integral velocity in terms of integral vorticity, you could add some classical harmonic function. So in case of constant linear momentum, this constant function is just constant. And I didn't add it in my solution.
But like the tails that you're comparing with here are based on numerics that are more general than the explicit classical solutions that you...
No. This green curve I know is k to the fourth. I'm not sure about others. But in general, what I hear in general is the following statement, that k to the fourth goes to something around 1.6, and k to the 2 goes to something around 1.2. And it's a shame that experiments cannot even give the second digits, the 1 point something. And usually experiments should have 1% accuracy, so maybe it should be like 1.6 something or 1.7 something. No.
You have mapped your complicated three-dimensional turbulence problems to one-dimensional fermionic systems. That's what you say.
Let me get closer to you.
So I want to understand.
Hold on.
So you said you have mapped.
Yes.
Your complicated average issues in three-dimensional turbulence to one-dimensional fermion problem.
Yes.
So can you elaborate on the one-dimensional, because we think we understand some aspects of one-dimensional fermion problem.
My solution does not apply to one dimension, doesn't apply to two dimensions, it only applies starting three dimensions.
No, but what I'm saying is, suppose I say I understand one-dimensional fermion problem very well.
Oh.
So how do I use my knowledge to understand the problem?
Oh, exact formula. Wilson loop equals expectation value of the one-dimensional fermion problem.
Beyond the formula, can you say some physical processes in one-dimensional fermion problem, which will reflect as vortex sheets and so on?
Ah, it's not vortex sheets. You see, it's a dual picture. It's average over distributed vortex sheets. So the only thing which is connected is the following, that the vorticity is cross product of P times delta P. So delta P is represented by some cyber. So it's a very good question. What really is important for this solution? But what I'm trying to say is the following, that solution of the turbulence is not related to solution of quantum system. It's related to solution of this quasi-classical limit. So this quasi-classical limit is much simpler than solution of one fermion system. It's solution of the density, classical density of fermions. So that classical density satisfies certain equation. And that equation is rather solvable.
That's, for example, in the context of one-dimensional fermion, you use bosonization very well.
Oh, I use it backwards. I started with sigmas, so I, well, maybe different kind of bosonization. Look, I welcome experts. I know that one-dimensional fermions is something very well studied, and I just scratched the surface. So I'm sure there will be some papers where, I hope there will be some papers where some exact solution using, I don't know, you know, Bethe-Ansatz or something, I'm sure there is exact solution. And that would be very useful because I made some assumptions when I computed my path integrals and my fluctuations, etc., etc. So maybe one could write down the Bethe-Ansatz and then just find the asymptotics clean way. That'll be very interesting. And lots of work for grad students and postdocs and even their advisors, because it's not an easy problem for a postdoc. Yes?
Yeah, my question might be a bit dumb because I didn't follow every detail, but it's quite often, like taking a classical limit, it's quite natural for an exact quantum system to be approximated by a classical system. Whereas here you seem to have the opposite going on, an exact classical system somehow being approximated.
No. Strong turbulence is equivalent to classical limit of the fermion system.
Okay, so the strong turbulent regime is equivalent to the classical limit of a quantum system, but not the quantum properties of that quantum system.
Well, it is, because this quantum limit is not just classical solution, it's WKB. It's like instanton calculation, except instanton calculation here is exact. So it's both classical action and fluctuations around this classical action. Determinant, functional determinant plays the most important role, which arises from fluctuations around classical solutions. So it's not classical, it's quasi-classical. So quasi-classical is exact. Well, that's what happens here.
Things like superposition or entanglement, they don't really play a role at any point in the turbulence.
I only considered one classical solution, and you mean there could be another one and there will be tunneling between them, that kind of thing?
I don't know how those phenomena in the quantum system would be reflected in the classical turbulence.
Look, I did the most obvious and trivial thing for the classical system, quantum system. I found the classical limit for the fermion density and found small fluctuations around that. That's all which was needed for me to compute my turbulent limit. So I don't know what happened. I'm sure there will be a lot of beautiful mathematical subtleties here. I just don't know them yet.
I wanted to ask a question.
Yes.
The shape of the loop at some point, I lost track of where the shape of the loop went.
It's functional of the loop. The loop have the shape of the Greek alphabet connected one to another.
And of course, I remember. So you're saying
any periodic function is called
P,
the loop.
You integrate P around the loop and then you
have algebra P. Yes. So the whole idea is, like, I cannot solve Laplace equation for x equals 7. I cannot solve something in loop space until I solve it as a function of the loop. It's a, my space is functional of all periodic functions.
Understand. Okay. I think this is a good time to pass.